self-nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the ungilded Dharma, not creating a veneer of attachment is called the precept of not misusing sex. The three wheels are pure and clear. When you have nothing to desire, you follow the way of all Buddhas. So we read this precept during our sutra service, and that's the first chunk of it, the emptiness chunk. So the first half of the precept takes the pure emptiness view. Desire nothing because there is nothing to attain. There are no separate beings anywhere. To attain nirvana is to have all desires cease. One might hope for this because being caught up in desire is often painful. Desire fuels the wheel of samsara, where we are filled with craving. We attain our desire, the fulfillment, maybe. The fulfillment is temporary, and we are filled with craving again. This can become a cycle of addiction in which we are only fleetingly satisfied with life as it is, if we are satisfied at all. Many monastics are thus expected to renounce sex entirely and are expelled if they break the precept. They even have to confess before the full assembly if they have sexual dreams. Probably a shameful experience for many. But as we know, repression of desire can cast shadows, including hidden abuses. Realizing the untenability of this, of strict adherence to this precept in many monastic sanghas, Japanese Zen temples reformed the rules, and priests were no longer expected to be celibate and were allowed to marry. We have a more language in our precept to accommodate non-celibate practitioners. Honoring mutuality and respecting commitment, I vow to take up the way of not misusing sex. In short, we don't deny human sexuality, but seek to avoid the harms caused from misusing sex. It's an interesting term, misusing. Though not everyone feels sexual desire, for many people it arises based on causes and conditions like any other physiological phenomena. If desires arise, it is important to acknowledge them. As Hogan Bays in our chant, Liberation from all Obstructions, writes, I vow to affirm what is. Being with what is, I respond to what is. It's interesting that liberation in this is not viewed as repression or denial, but affirming what is. While meditating under the Bodhi tree, the Buddha was tempted by Mara, the demon of delusion. Among others of his children, Mara sent lust to seduce Buddha. The Buddha responded to this temptation, Mara, I see you. And then lust vanished. Rather than deny sexual desire, Buddha simply recognized it, and then it passed, because it is empty of fixed essence. Because everything is impermanent, awareness is its own action. But even Buddha felt this desire, so no need to feel ashamed of it or repress it. This is one version of the middle way, neither repressing nor necessarily acting upon sexual desire, but merely recognizing its presence when it arises. Koans are meant to be provocative. There are only a few koans related to sex, one of which is in the koan collection, Entangling Vines. an abbreviated translation goes, an old woman built a hermitage for a hunk, and for a hunk. That's good. For a monk, and supported him. Hunky monk. Okay. An old woman built a hermitage for a hunky monk and supported him for 20 years. One day, to test the extent of the monk's enlightenment and understanding, she sent a young, beautiful girl to the hut with orders to embrace him. When the girl embraced the monk and asked, "How's this?" he replied stiffly, "A withered tree among frozen rocks, not a trace of warmth for 3 winters. Hearing of the monk's response, the old woman grabbed a stick, went to the hermitage, beat him, and chased him out of the hut. She then put the hermitage to the torch and burned it to the ground. So, what did the old woman expect from the monk? A 15th century Zen master and poet named Ikkyu, one of the only in our tradition who wrote openly about sex, replied to the koan, "If a beautiful girl were to embrace this monk, a withered willow would put forth fresh spring growth." A straightforward acknowledgement of a physiological response. Setting aside the quite problematic aspect of the old woman ordering the young girl to embrace the monk in the first place, the point appears to be that denial is not exactly our path. Repression can lead us to be cold and to lack compassion. It can also lead to unconscious expressions of repressed feelings. So here's another possible response. He might have said, "You are wonderful, but I'm living according to vows and must let you go." Not to say that's the answer. Sexual energy can be wild and disorienting. As Diane Rossetto writes, what begins as a biochemical resonance that drives all life quickly winds its way through the labyrinth of sensations, desires, fantasies, and wishes that can lead us into deep intimacy or into escapism or even into brutal abuse of others. The very surge and power of sexual energy can make it difficult to slow down and observe. And yet, if we do not know whether the situation might cause harm, slowing down and observing is a key part of our practice of the precepts, particularly when impulses grow strong. Then we can reflect on whether the expression of that energy might be an escape from other unresolved feelings, be harmful, or deepen healthy intimacy. First, escape. We've all likely used distraction to avoid feeling things that we don't want to face. We might turn on the TV, scroll on our phones, or find ourselves feeling sexually agitated. Not always bad to seek distraction, but sometimes it becomes an unhealthy habit of avoidance. Are we misusing sex to prop up our self-esteem or avoid grief? In a sense, that's like using a Band-Aid as a cast for a broken arm. We heal when we turn toward suffering and take care of it. Regarding avoiding causing harm, we might begin by considering mutuality from the precept. Is mutuality even possible in the context of unequal power dynamics? We're on thin ice here. While power dynamics are not always perfectly clear, sometimes there are hierarchies that should be acknowledged. The person with more power in a given context has a responsibility not to abuse that power and any associated transference for sexual gratification. Those with less power might also set clear boundaries and seek help if those boundaries are violated, but that's not always possible. It's ultimately up to those with greater power to avoid misusing sex with those with lesser power. Of course, not all romantic interests are abusive. Living Vow Zen's ethics policy states, as a non-celibate sangha, sexual intimacy is going to be a cherished part of life. However, any priest, teacher, or practice leader who finds a romantic relationship beginning with a member of the sangha should inform the Ethics and Reconciliation Ear Committee of this relationship and seek guidance as to the most helpful way to proceed. If no romantic relationship is desired, no consultation is needed, but if sangha leaders want to pursue a romantic relationship with a sangha member, we should consult for advice. Moving forward may entail giving up roles with the other person that creates an unequal power dynamic. This is just one example of how we might honor mutuality by helping reduce the likelihood that power dynamics could lead to abuse. And that's just in our sangha. In addition to honoring mutuality, respecting commitment is also a helpful guideline. There are many healthy forms of relationships, and that's important to acknowledge. The question might be, are we deceiving or betraying someone? A recipe for pain. The precepts are not meant to shame us, but to point to areas in life where human beings tend to cause suffering so that we can bring heightened attention and care. With sex, the energy can be seductive. The precepts invite us to be awake, to feel what we feel, but also to pause before acting when we are in precarious territory. Inflicting wounds can last a lifetime. And sex can also be beautiful, healing, an intimate expression of love, a joyful experience. Sometimes it helps to reflect on the precepts as aspirations rather than as injunctions. Diane Rossetto, again, translates the precept this way: I take up the way of engaging in sexual intimacy respectfully and with an open heart. Jack Kornfield, in a book called A Path with Heart, tells the story of a couple who had learned to meditate for hours in clarity, but who were overly passive and calm. Perhaps they were frightened of intimacy. It is a vulnerable thing. The husband, it is said, neglected his family, shushed and ignored the children, and the marriage was falling apart. The couple attended a sesshin, and the wife, in an interview with the teacher, asked, "Isn't this where spiritual practice leads?" Knowing better, the teacher asked them to practice with a new koan. How do you realize Buddha while making love? Quoting the story, Kornfield says that the teacher told them to do it while the other students were sitting and walking and to report their answer to him in interviews. According to Kornfield, the couple began to glow with a rosier energy. Okay, I don't love everything about that story. Just going to acknowledge that. But I will say this. Sex is often wondrous and all too often harrowing, but always a Dharma gate. The human heart is a tender thing. Thank you.